welcome to the Lorehounds podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to psycho history. I'm John.
And I'm Marilyn. This is our coverage of Foundation on Apple TV Plus, Season 3, Episode 1, A Song for the End of Everything. If you want to get in contact with us, send an email to empire@thelorehounds.com or head to our Discord server from the link tree in the show notes.
And if you like what you've heard from us and you want to support us or get ad-free and bonus content, check the same link tree for our Patreon and Supercast subscription options. Marilyn, it's our first episode.
Yes.
And we have to address the elephant in the room. David's
not
here. David's not here. David watched the first episode and a half of this season, and he wasn't a big fan of it, and he didn't want to. You know, we try to not cover things that we're not really into because
right.
It makes for worse content, and we don't want this to become a chore. So he wasn't very into it this season. That's okay. Marilyn and I were both really into it when we got our hands on these screeners.
Definitely.
And so Marilyn is going to be my co-host this entire season. We're going to have a great time doing it. So
yes,
thank you, Marilyn, for being here.
Oh, thank you for asking me, John. I'm quite delighted and thrilled. It's going to be very exciting.
I think it will be. I think we're in for a really great season. As much as I may have put a damper on things by saying David wasn't a big fan, I'm a big fan of what I've seen so far. I've seen the first two episodes, and I think it's great. Now, I'm not going to spoil anything in episode two. We are, of course, not going to spoil anything future, and
no.
I haven't seen much further, and I think it'll be very easy to separate because it's different subject matters. But I just want to say I'm a huge fan of the season. I think this is going to be a great time. We do have screeners, but we're not going to talk about anything ahead, and we're going to stay as close to in real time of our watching as possible. So we're going to try not to watch ahead as much as possible. Just
yep.
with scheduling, we might have to every now and then, but we'll be yep. very careful about spoilers.
Well, and I haven't watched season two yet. I mean, episode two yet. So,
you'll keep me accountable.
Well, I'll do my best. I will do my best. But I got to say, the trailer just made me think, oh, no, you know, with Goyer still present, but sort of on the out, they've decided to turn this into whiz bang, violent, you know, sci-fi battles and all the rest of it, because that's pretty much all they showed us just about. But watching the first episode relieved all of those fears for me. I have still a thing to say about it, but we'll get there when we get there.
Yeah, let's get to our hot takes in a minute. I will say, in a modern sci-fi show, you need a little bit of whiz bang to keep the audience going. But I think that so far, they've in the episode one, they've really stayed true to the Seldon type conflicts, right? These less violent conflicts.
Well, I may push back on that a little bit.
All right. Fair enough. I see what you're talking about. So, by the way, because we're recording these ahead, we're going to be recording these a little bit ahead of time. We're not going to do live feedback. We're going to hold that until we get a quorum, probably around the mid-season. I'm telling you this now, Marilyn, if you're okay with this.
Absolutely.
Around the mid-season and probably around the finale. So we'll see how much feedback we have. Maybe we'll do more if we get more feedback. But
sure.
I think we're going to have to do it that way because we're going to be ahead. So that's all the housekeeping in general. I want to, before we do hot takes, talk about our history with the Foundation books. So
sure.
Can you tell me your history with Asimov in general and the Foundation books?
Well, I can't tell you exactly when I first read them, but it was certainly like the very early 70s or late 60s. So the first three books, you know, the first book was a collection of short stories that was published in the 40s.
Right.
And then
is that the robot short stories?
No, the first stories in the volume one of Foundation were articles that were knit together to make this continue.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, well, and you can tell by reading them because they do seem serialized in a way. I mean, you have an episode here, and then you jump forward 100 years, and then here's another bit, and then here's another bit, so on. But he got better as he went along, and I've read all those, and then years later, when he started doing more, I read those. So I read the sequels, which came out after the original trilogy. And then I read the prequels. And I have to say, I think that of those three chunks, the prequels really are the best. I think he finally found his feet. That's the word. He finally found his feet, if I can find my words, as an author, as, you know, writing a continuous story, creating characters, doing all these things. And it really was quite fascinating some of the things that he came up with relative to, you mentioned the iRobot series, that becomes more obvious in right. those prequel volumes. So, right.
He does connect all three series, the Robot series, the Galactic Empire series, and the right. the Foundation series eventually. He right. kind of retroactively mm-hmm, connects mm-hmm. them all.
And it's interesting when certain things happen to think, oh yeah, well, you know, prior to this, this is what contributed to this and so forth.
What would Daniil Oliva do?
Pretty much.
Right. Well, very cool. So you've read all of the Foundation books then? Or yes. not? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was not sure if you were talking about the sequels too. I couldn't recall yes. if you mentioned them. Okay.
I great. Did. They're probably the weakest of the three chunks in mm-hmm. a way. But
I've heard that. Yeah, I read the first Foundation book a while ago when we were covering season two. Season two, you know, we have full coverage of that. If you're new here, you can go back and listen to all that. We were in a podcast during season one, so there's nothing there, but season two, we've got full coverage. And I actually didn't love the book that much the first read.
No.
I reread it over the last few days. Absolutely fantastic read. I don't know what changed for me. Yeah. Maybe I was just ready for it this time.
I think so. Also, it just the writing style was so very 40s and 50s.
Yes,
can be very off-putting.
Yeah, so I did actually go back and I read the first Empire book, mm-hmm. and then I read two Robot books, and then I went back and reread Foundation.
Wow!
So I think I was ready for Asimov this time.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Because Foundation is deep Asimov.
Definitely, and. He's a man of ideas, and mm-hmm. sometimes that can be difficult for people who want stories that, you know, have a lot of action and adventure right. and all that kind of stuff. And,
right.
And yeah, sometimes, I mean, when I was rereading Second Foundation and Empire for this, in preparation for this, I thought, you know, there's just an awful lot of chapters which are a bunch of white guys sitting in rooms smoking and talking politics, and it's like, right. Well, let's keep moving here.
You know, I think that's a really fascinating point because it is very much a white man in the 40s vision of the future, right? Like this is
oh, yes.
an extremely patriarchal society. Yes,
for sure.
Extremely, you get the sense that this is a predominantly white society. And now we have the show, which is incredibly diverse. One of the most diverse shows on TV, I'd say.
Yes.
And we interviewed David Goyer last season, not to humble brag, but we interviewed David Goyer last season. You can go back on the feed and check that out if you missed it. And he said, you know, we said, how did you approach this? Mm-hmm. And he basically was saying, I think this was in our interview, not somebody else's interview. I think this was in our interview. I haven't listened to it in a while. I should go back. That he just cast for the character, not for the race or the sex.
Yes.
And I think that's great. I think Gail Dornick works really well as a woman.
Wonderfully. Wonderfully well. And I have to say, you know, we do know that Asimov had issues around women and being grabby. And
sure did.
And there's two characters, one in the second volume, one in the third volume of the original trilogy, two women characters who are some of my favorite women characters in literature.
Okay.
So it's a really interesting admixture. You know, and you read from these women's perspective and you think, wow, this is fantastic. And then you go clunk over something that really,
right.
really dates it again. So,
and then you read another thing. It's like, well, you're counting women and children in the census. Like, why wouldn't you? Anyway, right.
Hello.
Anyway, so I'm actually currently reading Second Foundation. It's very confusing because the third book is Second Foundation.
I know.
I'm currently reading Foundation and Empire. I'm hoping to finish the series soon. The trilogy, the original trilogy soon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But overall, I just think that this show is such a fascinating example of sort of a show by inspiration. It's taking the ideas of Foundation and it's using them as colors on the palette, right? And yes. it's painting a new story using that. And I think it's an absolutely brilliant done show. Season one was good. Season two was great.
Yeah.
And I think season three can be great too. We just got to get there because we're only in the beginning.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing the rest of the season. So now that we've gotten through our first episode housekeeping, and don't worry, folks, we'll get to the hot takes sooner next episode. Give me your hot take on this premiere episode, Marilyn.
Except for the opening scene, I was delighted. I was thrilled. I really like the way they're bringing in characters whose names are very familiar to me, and giving us different polish on them, so to speak. I like very much what you talked about painting with the original stories. And in terms of the changes that they've made, particularly around how they have set up Empire and what it is and how it works.
Right.
Absolutely brilliant. And, you know, the challenge throughout, I think, has been, what do you do with a series in which all of your lead characters are going to be dead by the next chapter, episode, section, whatever?
You make sure they don't die or they're clones.
Right, exactly. Right. They just decided to do that, which is an interesting choice, and particularly if you set it aside next to the Rings of Power.
Right.
And the choices that they made dealing with that very same issue of, okay, elves live, quote-unquote, forever.
Right.
Humans come and go throughout. How do we tell the whole story of the Second Age and not lose our characters? And so they made a different choice. And both choices have their validity, and also, you know, they're stumbling blocks. But basically, I really like the things that they're doing.
Me too. I really love the fact that the different characters that get to stay around for different reasons, right?
Yes.
Harry Seldon, Vault Harry Seldon, at least, is a digital version. Gale is in a cryopod. Mm-hmm. The Cleons are just clones, and Demerzel's a robot. Like, every character that's going to stick around is there for a reason, and it's not just, well, we felt like having them stick around, so we made a lazy excuse. Like, I really think they're doing it brilliantly.
Yes, yes. There's very little jazz hands about why some of them are carrying on and others of them aren't.
Right, right.
And there's little look backs, there's little hints. We do hear much loved characters referred to subsequently. So.
Right. Well, any other thoughts on your hot takes?
Just that I can't wait to see all the directions they're going to take all these really interesting points in. And again, the one major change that I'm sorry that they did, we'll be very interested to see how that unfolds, and we'll get there when we get there in our discussion.
You know, I'm going to represent David here and say the show is incredibly beautiful. You know, yes. Nobody does sci-fi like Apple. Like, yes. Apple really has shown, I don't know. They're shining with sci-fi lately. Well, you know, when in doubt, go with the past participle.
Or present is shining.
Present participle, yeah. So I just think that it's beautiful. I mean, not just the VFX, but having Lee Pace go face-to-face with a camel to introduce what this current iteration of Brother Day is right now.
Yes,
having, you know, the scene where Brother Dawn gets poop thrown on him, or I guess it was dirt in the end. But having Demerzel pull the Prime Radiant out of her chest.
That was, oh my gosh, was that ever stunning. Really, really amazing concept. And the colors, just the colors themselves.
Absolutely.
Vivid, brilliant, contrasting, light, in the sense of bright, not in the sense of, you know, pale shades of whatever.
Yeah.
And bringing in the mythologies, you know, I'm going to have a lot to say about a certain scene and all the mythological
points. I know. I saw your notes. I'm excited to get to that.
Practicing up for when we start up Rings and Rituals.
Foundation and Rituals?
No.
I guess Foundation and Rituals. Foundation and Ritual would be a good title to a similar podcast, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Foundation and Empire. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. No,
that's great.
No.
All right. I will also say my criticism of this episode is that it is a huge exposition dump. My praise for this episode is this show needs an exposition dump at the beginning of each season because it's going going 152 years in the future, right?
Yes.
And so
this time,
So you cannot do this show without doing a little bit of over explaining in the beginning. I don't want that to happen every episode, but as long as it's mostly this episode, I think it's fine. I think it's fine.
I remember you saying that after telling me your initial reactions to it all, and so I was prepared, I guess, in a sense, because as I was watching, I'm thinking, I don't have any objection to this. I appreciate the reminders here and there. I mean, some of them I remembered, some of them I didn't, so...
Yeah. I mean, having Gail narrate everything, I was a little tired of her voice by the end of the episode, but in general, like, again, it's necessary. It's a necessary device for a show like this. It's a very unique show. with a very unique structure. It needs that extra little zhuzh just to get you along here.
Yeah, and they've already used her as a narrator before.
Plenty of times.
I think we can say it's a common thread throughout. In the same way that the structure that they gave to Empire is a common thread throughout.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And just stellar performances all around. Oh my gosh. I thought everyone did brilliantly. You know what shocked me is how well, I don't remember his name, but the actor for Brother Dawn, how well the actor for Brother Dawn is playing a cusp day. You know, he's doing the Lee Pace voice. He's holding himself like Lee Pace.
Yes, yes. It's a very interesting trend. Well, liminal spaces are always of interest to me. So we're very definitely in liminal time right now.
And I just think that actor is really nailing it. Like, he looks, he first of all, he looks like a young Lee Pace. They cast him well for that. That's not under his control.
Sure.
But just his mannerisms are becoming more Brother Day as he's 10 days away from inauguration.
And he's had to play so many different Brother Dawns. And he's very good at, you know, well, in this iteration, I have to be this.
Right. He was like a scared kid in the first one, right?
Right. And then the next one, he was a very uncertain teenager, if you will, because he began to suspect that the purity of the transitions was changing, and he was keeping it a deep, dark secret because at first he thought it was just him. And then he was right. But it wasn't that he was defective. It was that something else had been done to make the genetic drift happen.
Yeah.
And now this one, I just love, he's so full of confidence and assurance and authority. It's interesting you say that you're seeing him preparing to step into Day's role, because I didn't think about that at all. I just thought about it as, wow, this iteration of Dawn is much more confident.
It's almost like he had to become confident because his older brother was not.
Yeah, yeah. But I have to keep reminding myself, these are not the empires that you were looking at last time.
Right.
You know, because it's, you feel the sense of continuity regardless, even though you know, okay, this one is not the one that ran away with Sarath and they had a baby and whatnot. And so, of course, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, so when are we going to hear about that again? No?
Or will we? No, I think we will.
I think their child or their grandchild or whoever, in terms of the number of years that have transpired,
could create a succession crisis, right?
Almost unquestionably.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we get into the main episode now that we've given our hot takes?
Yes.
Let's start with the narration. 152 years since the second crisis, the Foundation controls the periphery and is pushing into the middle band, a string of independent planets. The Kleanic dynasty must use jump gates without the spacers, which has slowed the spread of Empire. So that climax of last season really put a damper on Empire, it seems like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, how could it not? You think back to the model that Asimov was working from of the Roman Empire. That's why they had to build all those roads. And as long as the roads were safe and secure and people could move across along them very quickly, they had that chance to expand out. But once they overreached and they were constantly pulling back, and locals would pry up the stones to build up their barns and houses and things, and the roads just began to deteriorate, and so did the Empire. Now, cause and effect, hard to say, but they seemed to run in tandem. So I thought it was an interesting way of depicting that same thing, and a good demonstration that if you have galactic ambitions, you have to be able to travel quickly from place to place.
Right, exactly. And here we have the Foundation being able to do that. And so they're in their expansionist era. They're trying to push into the middle band.
Yes, and they are.
Empire is just doing everything it can to push the Foundation back.
Yeah.
To hold them back, I would say. Not even push. They're just like holding on for dear life here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Fingers in the dike time.
And now we see, of course, we have a new focal point here, Colgan. Mm-hmm. So on Colgan, the mule meets an army alone and unarmed. Archduke Balerion. I'm saying that based on what I heard. We don't have subtitles. So Archduke Balerion attempts to get his daughter back from the mule. The mule demands as ransom the entire planet and to be named warlord. which makes the Archduke laugh, of course. Mm. The Archduke says this will trigger a war between the Empire and Foundation, and the Mule says he intends to consume both. When the Mule's demands go unmet, he causes the entire army and space fleet to kill each other. He takes the Archduke's signet, freshly bitten off, and saunters away. I know you have a lot of thoughts on this, so go for it.
Well, why don't you start with recognition that we have a recast of the Mule?
We did have a recast of the Mule. So the actor, I don't have the actor's names on top of it, but this is Euron Greyjoy from Game of Thrones. He was in the last couple seasons.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I deeply regret that he looks so much like the character from the previous Dune series that we saw, Dune Prophecy.
Oh,
I had a really hard time when I'm watching the trailer. Like, oh no, it's not that. It's this.
Funny.
Even the way they hold their eyes, it's well, I'm getting used to it, but it was something of a shock.
Yeah, I didn't really watch Dune Prophecy. I watched the first couple episodes, so it didn't shake me as much.
Okay.
Also, I know this actor from a previous show.
Sure, so which helps.
It helps and it doesn't, right? Because he's still Euron Greyjoy a little bit.
But the other problem is, they're both trying to do more or less the same thing.
Sure.
Through other than, you know, physical physics means, you know,
right,
which is controlling people without the usual, you know, weapons and armies and all that kind of stuff. So
right.
It's a psychic kind of a thing. So it makes it even harder to say, nope, this is not the same thing as that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he did a great job. The Mule from last season, we don't know exactly why he was recast. There were some rumors about allegations. There was also just the fact that maybe they wanted a bigger actor for this season because this is going to be the main villain.
Mm.
It seems like, at least based on the trailers and based on this episode, he's setting up to be a pretty big problem.
Yeah, well, I admit to being confused at first, and all the more so because the look just made me think Dune.
Right.
A while, but I got over it.
So I actually liked the scene. I thought it made him, it was a great way to introduce a very formidable foe, right? Like, this is someone who could take down an army when you get there.
No, unquestionably they are demonstrating the power of this individual. And when it is, you know, the visual presentation and not something you can read about, I understand why they felt the need to emphasize more the physical stuff. But as far as I'm concerned, it was far more violent than in the books. And to my mind, not necessary. But also, just a side note here, I think, you know, the wonderful opening images that they
beautiful.
Do. Yeah. I think we see his face as one of the last images on the right.
Okay.
During that intro. So next time you watch it, look at it and see what you think about that.
I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah. Asimov himself, you know, there's a couple of pertinent quotes to this. He, in The Currents of Space, he wrote, "What could be more eloquent as a condemnation of war than war itself?" So he was basically against war. He was born in Tsarist Russia and emigrated with his parents, and, you know, his life was lived during that time of extreme violence and pogroms because they were Jewish. So I can see why he was led to have this aversion to violence. But throughout the series, the first three books, well, throughout the entire series, various characters over time say, violence is the last refuge of the incompetent.
Right. Salver Hardin, original
quote. Salver Hardin. Yep. We've heard that once or twice.
Yeah.
So it's not like they completely dropped it and ignored it. So if the Mule is as incompetent as he is, that is where his terror lies in the book series. But here, you know, yes, it's gobsmacking to suddenly have your ships turn and fight and kill each other and to have all your armies right in front of you, all that. There's a lot of, whoa, what is this dude? But then, you know, to force the guy to bite off his own finger, I'm sorry, I didn't watch that, you know. As it happened, I was eating dinner at the time. And, oh, wow, this was a really bad choice. But, you know, it's shocking. And I think with that emotional charge, you also get that stronger sense of, okay, this guy is crazy nuts.
Yeah.
And has this ability that we don't understand. But in the books, the mule was such a different character. And they took a completely different tack to presenting him, to having him taking over, you know, one by one, the areas that he did. And I missed that. You know, I was looking forward to seeing that represented. So, I don't know. I think book people will have to come to terms with that in some fashion or other. But it's clear that they've made the choice to go the violent route as much as possible. And I'm sorry for that. But
yeah, I'll admit I have not gotten up to the big mule sections of Foundation and Empire.
Well, I'll be very interested to hear your thoughts when you do.
Yeah, I might feel differently once I get there. Mm-hmm. As of right now, I'm okay with having a more violent villain as well as the political situation that Foundation is finding itself in. I would be more bothered if the Foundation were getting really violent, because that would feel very anti-Seldon to me.
Well.
No, maybe I haven't read
breeding.
That part yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just don't have a preconceived notion of the mule. And no. And I'll say many characters have been completely changed. Like Salver Hardin saying violence is the last refuge of the incompetent.
Right.
Boy, does Salver Hardin do a lot of gunslinging in the first couple seasons.
Yes, she does. Yes, she does.
Plus, you know, Hober Mallow, completely different character in the books.
Yes. And that was okay. For yeah. whatever reason, for me, it was successful. Now, the part of the reason why I wish the mule hadn't been altered is because he becomes such a central driver for one of the two women characters who I like so much.
Okay.
And I'm afraid that they may just be omitting her altogether. But we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
It's early days. It's only episode one of season three.
Well, we've already gotten rid of Archduke Balerion. Which I love that actor. He's fantastic. He's in The Witch. He does a lot of voice acting in video games because he's just got like one of the deepest voices out there. Love him. Love him. Absolutely brilliant. Are you a fan of this guy?
I've never heard of him. I don't recognize him. It's completely off the
You know, I kind of want to tell you to watch The Witch. It's not really violent. It's horror, but it's
I don't do horror either, John.
It's an allegory, but it's an allegory for the deadly sin. And it's very Christian influence. I think you would like it mm-hmm. a lot. And he's the father mm-hmm. in that. He's this colonial era, very religious father.
Yeah. 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 There were a lot of those around.
Yep. Yep.
Besides, as a Quaker, you know, I don't think too much of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, and because they burned a bunch of us and executed us and
tied us to the back
of carts and whipped us out of town. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, this guy in the movie was so extreme that they kicked him out of town, and that's the whole start of the movie.
Yeah.
They said, take your family and go if you're not going to live in peace.
Oh, that's right. And they go off into the woods and they eventually, one by one, go crazy nuts.
Kind of.
Yeah. No, I remember when it came out, and I remember reading things about it and thinking, bah.
Oh, it's a very good movie. I think it's the best horror movie ever made.
Well, on the other side, it's slamming, you know, pagan practices and all that sort of thing. So they're kind of, it's a 1-2 punch for me.
I actually don't think they slam pagan practices. Anyway, we don't have to go there right now. We're not talking about
that program. We're talking about this one.
Right, exactly. Anyway, I loved him in that movie. He's great here. I wonder why he's just taking a lot of these roles where you're in it for a little bit and then you're out. So I think, but great addition for the few minutes he was here.
Sure.
And the mule was scary.
The mule was unquestionably scary. He was, you'll pardon the expression, batshit crazy as far as I'm concerned. And you could bleep that if you need to, but I don't think you do.
Now I will say, as much as I am excusing the violence here, you know, the presence of it in the show. Not that what he did was right.
Sure.
But as much as I'm saying this doesn't bother me, I hope that this is not what he does every time he walks into a room.
I hope so, right? Too, John.
I hope that he's more interesting than just the guy who makes you all kill each other.
Which, you know, as you say, after two or three times, you just see it coming. And it's kind of ho-hum.
So I trust David Goyer. He was still showrunner this season. He was still writing a lot of this.
Yes, yes.
I trust him to not be doing a boring thing with him. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I hope you're right.
All right. Any other thoughts on this scene?
Nope.
All right. Let's take a break and we'll come back and continue on. We're back and ready to convene with Brother Don. Demerzel tells Don the third crisis is approaching, but also that a new inflection point has suddenly appeared. Don travels to Clarion Station to meet with the Galactic Council. Don walks through a group of protesters, which throw dirt at him, and tells the council it is time to support the Merchant Princes, a group of dissenters within the Foundation. With 10 days to go before his inauguration, Don calls the presider's bluff and gets a vote on the proposal. There was no change in the upcoming inflection point.
Mm-hmm.
I love this Don. We were talking about it before, but
yeah.
Really a man about business, right? He comes in, the presider goes, well, Brother Day isn't here. He goes, we could wait 10 days and we could also have another vote about your status.
Yeah. He's very sharp. Very, very sharp. Also, I really appreciated seeing Don and Demerzel working in such unity.
I agree. And she gives him kudos, right? She goes, that was absolutely nicely handled.
Yeah, no, and I liked seeing him have such confidence. And I thought that having a Galactic Council scene was an excellent way to show Don's maturing.
Yeah.
Because talk about being wise about, you know, human machinations and political currents and all that kind of thing. And there was the whole symbolism of what they threw at him was dirt from a planet. And I've only watched it once, so I can't remember the specifics of that. But it kind of brought home some of the reason why the protesters were making so much noise.
Right. So this is, it's really interesting because now that I'm reading the books, he's really mixing and matching the timelines here, right? Like the traitors absolutely. Are happening after the Empire business, and it's really, really mixing and matching, but that's okay with me. I think as long as we touch all these points, it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I did note that he's been in touch with Randu Mallow. So I'm assuming this is related to Hober Mallow.
Well, possibly, you know, the child of her grandchild.
Right. Cause we know, Brother Constant and Hober Mallow got it on.
Yes, they did. Yeah, I thought the Galactic Council scene was an excellent way to show him maturing. I also thought it was an interesting play to suggest that the Empire merges with the Foundation now that the Merchant Princes are rebelling. It's a different flavor from what I would have expected from the trilogy.
Yeah. You're saying they're merging with the Foundation?
Well, just insofar as there's a Foundation representative on this council.
Oh yeah, they're being diplomatic here.
Yeah, which I can't really see happening it never did happen to my knowledge in the books.
We have Russian and Chinese ambassadors here. You know, like that's fine. There's an ambassador there.
Sure, no, that's fine. But I mean, it's outside the sphere of the original. But it raises some more interesting points. It also felt very odd to me to have the Empire using the Selden plan.
That is very strange.
I wondered if this was a Goyer idea since it was introduced at the end of season two.
I think most of the season is still going to be Goyer ideas the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, his writer's room. I know he has a writer's room too. Mm-hmm. But I think that's within his purview. I think it's really interesting because, you know, at this point, we know from this episode that Demerzel knows this Empire will end, right? Like one day she will lose her purpose.
Absolutely.
But she does, you know, as a positronic robot with the Xerath law, she does want humanity to go on without her, without Empire too. And so she's still for, again, she goes, I ask myself why he gave it to me, right?
Well, and so do a bunch of the rest of us. it's a very, I have some speculation at the end as to why that might have happened. Have you read Second Foundation yet?
No, I'm only in Foundation and Empire and pretty early on.
Okay, well then I won't spoil it beyond just to say that the representation of the prime radiant is clearly, the physical representation is clearly a Goya representation. And
okay.
And I think it's an improvement among so many improvements. But when you get there, I'll be interested to hear.
Yeah, it's beautiful in the show. I mean, I have no idea what Asimov was thinking of back in the day, but beautiful in the show. I mean, it's, one wonders how you read it if you're not a robot, right?
Well, or Harry Seldon or someone steeped in psychohistory.
Even them, like, what language is that?
Mathematics.
Oh, boy. Not for me.
Not too much for me either.
Well, I mean, I will say one thing on the Galactic Council here. I don't love that they say in the narration, the Galactic Council is as old as Empire. That didn't feel right to me, right? Like, no, Empire was an absolute monarch for a while. That was the whole point. It was very, very strong.
I think they should have just said,
right. I think Gale should have just been saying, you know, as it weakened, the people demanded representation.
Right.
There became a Galactic Council. I think that would have been fine. Minor critique, but I was like, it would have been nicer to say it's out of weakness that this even exists.
Definitely.
And Empire is annoyed that it has to exist.
And all of your nobles nibbling around the edges and you know, some of the great generals, trying to rebel and whatever.
Right.
They're not hewing as closely to the line of Roman history as was Asimov himself. But that's okay.
Yeah. I'm just really enjoying this whole Brother Dawn deal, but and the Galactic Council, I think there could be some interesting stuff there. Like you said, Foundation representation is interesting. I don't know if I'd call it representation, actually, because it sounds like an ambassador. I don't think they're
you may be power. Right. I mean, we see her at the dinner table. But is she in the Galactic Council?
I don't think so.
Or is any representative? Yeah, see, I didn't think so either.
Oh, I thought you were saying she was at the Galactic Council and I just missed it.
Oh, no. No, I wasn't. I'm not clear on that one way or the other.
Okay.
Sorry. Only one watch.
That's all right.
But the fact that they're even talking to the Foundation and receiving them in this August manner, very different.
Hey, buddy, we did try to destroy your whole civilization, but sorry.
Yeah.
It's interesting because the Foundation was supposed to be underground, wasn't it? Like, I assumed that the Foundation was going to be underground at the end of last season.
Keep reading.
But watching. I don't know why
they really couldn't. The TV series really, I don't think, could really leave them underground and still be as faithful as they have been to the books.
Still go forward in the story.
Exactly.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying. All right. Well, because let's move on.
The original story, you know, the original planet was not destroyed.
Right.
So they didn't have to go anywhere else.
Now we get new Terminus, but not yet. Yeah. First, we've got to go visit with the other versions of Empire. Dusk and Day.
Oh, Torment. Yes.
Dusk torments himself with recordings of the previous Dusk's deaths. He laments the incompetence of Cleon the 17th, who lost the Spacers last season. He and Dawn discuss their political predicament and muse over the mule. After a dinner with Foundation Ambassador Quent and Zephyr Varalis, again, no subtitles, so if I'm a little wrong on that, sorry, Dusk goes off to find Day. He finds Day on a bender with his lover and drug dealer, Song, letting it all hang out while he avoids his duties. Dusk tells Day it's time to get rid of Song or it will be done for him. Day finally goes to work and sees the impending inflection point in the Prime Radiant. Darkness comes, and the end of Empire is in 4 months, ending the usefulness of the Prime Meridian and making extinction possible. Can I just say, boy, something awakened to me when Lee Pace goes, "Welcome to my filth," shirtless on the balcony. I was, oh,
Mr. I'm not Pace. Sure I want to know what woke up for each other.
Something within me, Marilyn, all right?
Oh, okay. It's, you know, It's your reactions,
Mr. Pace.
No judging.
My God, you can't do that to me on a random weekday.
Oh yes, he can. It's interesting. I was really glad that they had that useful reminder that this is not the same Cleon who lost the Spacers last season. Of course, we know that. Spoilers for the previous season, folks. We know that because we watched him floating off into space.
Right.
Nevertheless, I can absolutely see a continuity in character and in response from that day to this day. And of course, because it's always Lee Pace, I think that makes it more difficult to say, wait a minute, this is not the 17th, this is the whatever it is, 18th or 19th? I don't know.
This, I mean, he seemed like a completely different person to me. I thought he did a great job.
Oh,
yeah, I thought it was much different than the previous day. The previous day was petulant, but he wasn't like uncaring, right? He did want to get the job done. And this guy is just like, if you like pina coladas, he's making camels and ferrets. I love, I'll just remember the girl with the yeast from Dusk. Because she's from the yeast factory or something.
See, I can easily see a continuity between the petulant but well-intentioned and the sybaritic.
Yeah, I mean, continuity, completely not sure. Care
because he has only 10 more days to live, quote unquote.
Oh, sorry, Day because has 10 more days to live?
Well, they're all going to get it.
Well, right? Day's going to become
everybody
dawn.
Has system.
But sorry, Day's going to become dusk.
Day's going to become dusk.
And then I don't know. Does dusk immediately die? Because there was some comment about 6 months. I think dusk has 6 months, right?
There's a brother knight. And it's NIGHT. And it's the brother knights that get dissolved. Right. And I don't know how long a period of time there is between his
I thought they
translation
said something
from
about 6 months.
Knight, but yeah, but that sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
It sounds reasonable.
You know, they get to cuddle the baby for 6 months and then grandpa goes off to the sunset.
And as you noted, they're openly talking about the decanting now.
I know. I was like, oh, this is not a secret anymore. I would have thought that Demerzel tamped that down with the memory deletion at some point.
Well, evidently, maybe she's got too much else on her robot
boys,
mind
deal
at
with
this
it.
Point. But yeah, no, I mean, she's juggling so many things there. Plus, she's having her own personal crisis, which we will bring up shortly.
Yeah, she is.
My first reaction to the whole thing was, we say Day looking like John the Baptist and acting like Nero in the final days of Rome. So again, I really think that they're emphasizing this fall of empire trope.
Right.
And drawing, I mean, they're bringing camels for crying out loud. How can you not think of the Middle East when you see a camel? Apologies, that's stereotypical, I know. But between that and his, you know, the hair, the first scene we see of him is, you know, he's, instead of being the classic emperor, clean cut, clean shaven, he's got the beard and the mustache and the hair down to his shoulders. And, you know,
he's got the wonderful like, drugs, as he says.
Yeah, looks like John the Baptist to me.
Okay. So, I didn't put the John the Baptist together, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah. And I, you know, Dawn and Dusk are trying to hold it together, which again mirrors season two's Dawn and Dusk are trying to hold it together while that day, the 17th, was, you know, going off the rails. So that's probably another reason why I'm just feeling this continuity. Dawn, of course, is anticipating it all with pleasure. It's interesting, what was your word about Dusk and anticipating his...
He torments
himself, right. I just felt he was being really cynical and using this fierce cynicism, watching each of the brother knights before him being disintegrated and noting the individuality of the response.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, they're not supposed to be individuals. So
right.
Another way of emphasizing the fact that, you know, the original plan got messed up. And I believe it was in season two that we learned that it was one of the rebel groups or whatever that introduced the genetic variation into, one of the little embryos floating in their amniotic fluid.
Can't fix it anymore.
And there's nothing more they can do because they've lost the quote unquote purity of the original.
Right.
So, and again, emphasize genetic purity has been lost.
Right.
And both of them want to try and preserve empire. But when Demerzel shows all three of them that the Prime Radiant indicates the end of empire and the end of the civilization because of the mule, I'm wondering how that's going to affect the three of them in terms of their attitudes towards, you know, will Dusk suddenly say, oh, well, it's all going to go to hell in a handbasket anyway, so why not? I might as well get out before, you know, the palace falls around my ears. Kind of
thing. I wonder that too. I mean, this Dusk does seem to be a little nihilist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like if I rush toward it and embrace it as much as I possibly can, maybe it won't hurt quite so much. You know, hurt in an emotional sense, not in a physical sense. It doesn't look like it's a painful process or whatever. But
no, it looks like it's pretty quick, honestly.
I mean, it raises an interesting philosophical question, which is, do you want to know the day you're going to die?
You know, that comes up in one of the Empire books, right? That's in Pebble in the Sky.
I haven't read those, but okay. I'm not surprised that it does.
That's the only Empire book I've read, but there's this whole thing where everybody on Earth at that point has to submit themselves to die at 60.
Well, that's, yeah, there's various books and authors who have used that concept, yeah. Haven't they, over the years?
And people will be like proud of it. They're like, you know, I've got 10 years and 2 days left, and right. I'm using every one of them, you know, right. like.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And there's this book that I absolutely adore about life of nuns in a convent in the southeast part of England. And one of them at one point says, I just wish I knew what day I was going to die. And they said, why, sister? And she says, so that I know what to read next.
That's funny.
So
that's very funny.
It depends on any number of things, I suppose.
Yeah. I am really loving this trio right now. I think every season has another really interesting trio, and this trio has a dynamic that feels ripe for comedy.
And it's the same actors every time.
I know.
So I think they must be growing, bouncing off each other in some ways.
Right.
And deepening and of course they've got marvelous material to work with. So
Right.
I'm hoping they're having the time of their lives, because I don't think that any of them will ever be in a project that's exactly like this one.
Oh, no. I mean, what could be, right? Anything that was like this one would be just a ripoff of this one.
Right. But having such a chance to display the full range of your acting skills and
right.
what kind of chops can you bring to
right.
an episode, it's really remarkable.
Well, why don't we talk about the vault? Let's head to New Terminus, where the Foundation has rebuilt its headquarters while the faction of traitors is threatening to secede. Ebling Miss goes to the vault and nulls the null field to awaken Harry Seldon ahead of the third crisis. Seldon deduces that the merchant princes have risen as the religious age ended. When he learns that Empire is holding on better than expected, he says it's because he gave them the Prime Radiant. When Ebling demands a reason why, Seldon ejects him.
Yeah. I've been asking that question myself. I'm really glad that we have Ebling Miss. He's a significant character in Foundation and Empire. I like that they've toned him down a little bit. He still uses one of his favorite exclamations of galaxy. and he's not quite so much of a weird screwball in this instance, but although he's still something of the parody of a scholar, which is what he is. And, you know, he's been studying all his life, and this is just the most proudest moment of his life. He's been waiting for this encounter with Seldon and wants to tell Seldon all about how excited he is about it. And then when Seldon tells him that he gave the Prime Radiant to Empire, Miss is astounded and he gets booted back out of the vault.
right, exactly. I love their interaction, the whole thing. From,
isn't it great?
He nulled my null field.
Yes.
No one's ever done that. Well done.
Yes, that was perfectly played, pitch perfect.
Yeah.
Because you expect he's going to say, get out of my hair. And then he says, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. All right, you earned to sit down in my office.
Right. You earned a visit.
Right.
You earned a visit.
Until you make me angry.
Yeah. Or, you know, question my actions.
Right.
Probably the worst thing anybody could do.
I know. But don't question the psychohistorian.
Yeah. And I like the way that they are emphasizing, even if they're not going to show us a lot of it. And they've showed it a little bit, but they might show us more. They might not. But they're emphasizing that the traitors rebelling is setting up to be the next crisis.
It's something that happens in the books too, where
yes, exactly.
every time a, well, the traitors in general, but every time that there's a Seldon crisis coming, there's certain characters who go, my Seldon sense is tingling, and they go, I feel it. There's a Seldon crisis coming.
I feel the force of the crisis.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, no spoilers from the books other than the fact that the traitors were a faction in the book too.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And play an important role.
Right.
But it's fascinating again to me how he's echoing the books without simply replicating them.
Right.
Step by step. What you called it? Painting with the...
Using the palette of the books.
Using the palette of the books. Well, this whole scene is an excellent example of that. The vaults in the books is... nowhere near as interesting.
The vault is just a series of recordings, right? It's just
exactly a
hologram plays after every crisis and is like, hey, good job.
Yeah.
If you're here, good job. If not, I guess you died. That's basically what the recording says.
I have no idea if I'm talking to anybody or not, if anybody is present. And they actually do mention in the books that there were one or two crises where nobody even went to the vault.
No, really?
Because they felt confident enough that they knew what was going on and what they needed to do.
Hmm.
But they also, in the books, raise this interesting question, and I'm not sure if they're going to do this or not. The tension between, on the one hand, the only way psychohistory can work is if it's dealing with massive numbers of individual behaviors that then make them predictable, whereas the actions of a single individual are supposedly not predictable. And therefore, when the leaders of the community say, oh, it's a Seldon crisis, we have to do this out of the other, you get this pushback of, no, the best thing we can do is do nothing, because it's not supposed to come about, the resolution, through the interventions of individual people. But leaders
can be more than individuals, right? They can move masses. So,
well, I think that's one of the points, perhaps, that Asimov is making.
Right, right, exactly. Like, Salvor Hardin... sure, solve the first crisis or the second crisis, kind of both, right?
Whichever.
Yeah, in the books, there's a different set of crises. But here, Salvor Hardin solves the first crisis. The second crisis is, you know, Hober Mallow is involved and all that, and El Rios. And each one of these are individual actions, but they impact so many different people that you could see how that affects psychohistory.
And I think the best explanation I can come up with right now for that is, looking at the massive statistical numbers and variables, the projection is that some Belriosley-like figure will result from all of this and therefore will act in ways that psychohistory...
Yeah.
They didn't predict that it was going to be this particular general this time, but they did predict that as the power of the empire fades, then the generals are going to increase and so on and so on.
It's very similar to me to the pattern of the Wheel of Time, right? Okay. So when the pattern is demanding that the dragon should be reborn, a bunch of false dragons pop up, right? So all these things are like, the pattern will give you a new thing a new figure to fit the bill of the main arc of history if the individuals fail, right? And it's the same thing as Spabimi with Tolkien.
Sure.
Is the individuals can take actions, but really Eru's plan is going to go whatever is going to happen is going to happen. It's who's involved that can change, and it's how it happens exactly.
But you still have this tension between was it the individual or would it have happened anyway? You know,
right.
If not this one, then someone else.
Right.
And how important are the individual actions? And then, of course, you also have the whole free will versus fate question. So it's a fascinating concept in and of itself, and it can lead to lots of different discussions.
It's really interesting because it raises a lot of religious questions in a society that is math-based, right? This is science.
Right.
I think that's why this series is so interesting to talk about.
And at the same time, mathematics is a language.
Yeah.
And true. You use a language to tell a story.
It has a lot better rules than English, though.
Well, I think, you know, really deep mathematicians, if they're honest, will tell you that the laws of mathematics are not quite as rigid as many of us believe. Now, that may be because different approaches are taken. I am not a mathematician. I did not take any maths after high school. I managed to scrape by a high enough on my AP score in college math that I did not have to ever set foot in a mathematics classroom again, which was fine with me.
I, too, did the same thing. I didn't take any math in college because I scored well enough in high school. Yeah, but
the concept of E came along and just completely wrecked me. I'd been doing fine mathematically up until that point.
Oh,
and
boy.
That was when I just said, nope, sorry.
Well, we'll leave it to Harry Seldon and Gail Dornick.
Yes, we will.
All right. Let them handle all the math for us. We'll just talk about this show. But first, let's take our second break and get right back to it. Are you ready, Marilyn, to go to Haven?
Oh, interesting place.
The traitors have established a stronghold on Haven and are preparing for a civil war using Imperial weapons. Han Pritcher and another Foundationer scout, another Foundationer scout for proof of the Imperial collaboration. They see a trade happen but need to secure proof. Han spots Randu Mallow, leader of the traitors, pick up the shipment. The Foundationers chase Randu, but he gets away, and they flee to New Terminus. The woman tries to kiss Han, but he holds up a necklace to stop her just in time to see an alert about the mule. On New Terminus, Han requests permission to investigate the mule instead of the traitors, as he thinks they are a distraction from his mutant abilities. When Pritcher lashes out, Mayor Indber suspends Han's privileges, launch privileges, but not before Han steals the leader's keys. What did you think of Mayor Indber, first of all? Because that was honestly one of the parts of the episode that I didn't enjoy. I thought it was a little over the top.
Well, he is absolutely spot on in terms of the book, Mayor Indber.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely.
I kind of want him to go, would you like a jelly baby? Like from Doctor Who? You know?
No, his line, I am the Foundation, you know, Très Louis the 14th. And that's exactly the flavor that has come about by Foundation and Empire in terms of how the Foundation has developed as a civilization.
Yeah.
You have these mayors that are mayor for life, and then it's an inherited position. It's no longer voted. There's a lot of authoritarianism. Democracy is not very much in evidence. So, I thought that they were very efficient about presenting all those ideas in this one person who is utterly obnoxious, but, you know, that's kind of the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the same thing of Pritcher insisting that the mule is the danger and nobody believing him, or at least, you know, Indber not believing him, and probably a lot of the Foundation not believing him either.
Right.
Certainly.
Thankfully, they announced the cast for Mayor Indber. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known his name. They're not naming a lot of people in this. Like, they didn't name the other Foundationer with Han.
No, and that makes me really wonder, is this woman going to be Beta? B-A-Y-T-A, who is one of my favorite characters in the whole series.
Okay.
Maybe. I'm just not sure how they're going to use it. And, of course, they do the whole tease of, I have no idea what it is that Han has around his neck that he holds up to indicate that he is what, monogamous, committed?
It's actually a kyber crystal, you say, he's a Jedi.
Right. And,
can't form attachments.
Or he's a monk, or, I don't, you know, who knows?
Yeah. The religious era is over, though. We can't have any more monks in the Foundation.
Well, you know, the religious era may be over in a lot of people's eyes, but that doesn't mean there aren't still people who are very religious.
That's true.
So,
that's true.
But I didn't get the sense it was a religious thing, but maybe it was. You know, we'll find out. We'll find out.
It could be,
I hope.
You know, like a wedding ring, right? It could be that the necklace is a symbol of marriage.
Right.
Who knows?
Right.
Who knows? I guess we'll find out as we go along. What'd you think of this hot and cold planet? This one side is will burn you alive, the other side is freezing, and you gotta chase the moon.
They gave us this incredible visual representation of this remarkable concept straight from the books. You know, a planet that they call it a ribbon because it's a ribbon around the planet, which is the only safe zone. But within that safe zone, it is like a tropical paradise. Hence, Haven is the name of the planet. But instead of having, you know, a lot of exposition explaining it, they just show you the desiccated bodies of the people who tripped over the line or got shoved over something.
That's crazy.
The moon thing, I think, is original to the series. I don't remember anybody mentioning that they chased the moon, but it reminded me of the previous season when we had Harry Seldon as a child on that planet, which was so very close to the moon that those creatures could, the herd of creatures could gallop past him and then fly up to the moon because it was on one of its cycles in which it was very close. And they had to do that for their own biological whatevers. So I thought it was another interesting way to depict planets that are quite different from our own.
I thought that was great. And, you know, one of the criticisms I'm going to talk tonight, one of the criticisms of Star Wars that we see is that all these planets start to feel very samey, right?
Exactly.
And this is one where this did not feel the same as anything I've ever seen in sci-fi.
No, I know. I've not seen anything else like it anywhere either.
Very cool. Very, very cool as a ribbon planet.
Yeah.
I love this idea of like, don't get outside the safe zone or you're going to be done for.
Seriously. And you asked the question, why is this not all cleaned up and refurbished as an amenity for the community?
I don't think I asked that.
Oh, I didn't.
I didn't write that. Who wrote this?
I don't know, but I didn't write that. I did not write that sentence.
Who's been in our outline? Could have been David. He did watch this episode.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. He should have given us his initials. But anyway.
Yeah, right.
I think the simple answer is, that amount of land and an otherwise inhabitable space, every single inch is precious. And the people who are, you know, native there are not really going to be all that interested in having, you know, people from other planets that are coming as a sort of a vacation spot. Calgon was supposed to be the vacation island. And I pronounce it Calgon because it reminds me of that. It came from back in the 60s for, I think it was a bath oil called Calgon. And the tagline was, Calgon, take me away. How you're supposed to be luxuriating in this wonderful, you know, sybaritic sort of thing. And that's exactly what the planet Calgon is supposed to be in the Asimov world. So I don't know. Maybe it's a false connection, but I just thought it was funny.
Well, I like that. I like make all the connections you want. Maybe they'll come together. Remember, David Goyer came on our podcast to tell us that we were wrong about Markley. So
well, there you go.
We got.
I mean, I'm not clinging to it the way you guys cling to Markley.
Listen, I didn't cling to Markley at all. I don't take any responsibility for
I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon.
I did. I don't think so.
No, I say I beg your pardon for implying.
Oh, okay, that you did.
Okay. Yeah. I'll be interested if any listeners remember that ad and had the same.
That was a very funny moment. I'm glad that David hooked on to Markley because it got David Goyer to come on and tell us how wrong we were.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he had to set the record straight. So I mentioned before that Randu Malo, possibly a descendant of, or we both mentioned, somebody mentioned a possible descendant of Hobarmer the Constant. And this character seems to be doing a stand-in for one of the characters from the second volume in the series with the one arm and being a traitor. I have to pronounce it carefully. I think it's traitor. So they're kind of playing around with all this, but I'll be interested to see if this woman is supposed to be Beta or not.
Yeah.
But they never gave us her name. So, you know, maybe she was just a random person that the Rebelling Foundationers sent out.
Yeah, that could be.
To Han to say, okay, help him out. Do whatever he needs to have done.
Right. Han's got his own thing going on. We're definitely going to see more Han. And I enjoyed the pod racing too. That was very good.
Yes. Yes. Such a very short incident.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they put so much into it, so much creativity.
That's
so
the kind detail. Of exposition we need, right? Is exactly. Just show me, don't tell me.
Exactly. And it's easier to do with some things than others, of course.
Right.
But no, I thought this was a superb scene.
Right.
From yeah. many perspectives.
Absolutely. Well, we have no more candy for Mayor Inber, so let's move on to Demerzel.
Even that detail was in the books.
That's funny.
That he had these different candies that he did. Yeah.
That's
I really liked that whole thing a lot.
Well, Han played him really well by pissing him off with all the candy stuff and then
absolutely
grabbing his jacket and, you know, palming the key.
Yep.
Well, Demerzel's up next. That's the last section here. A Luminous Priestess arrives to meet with Demerzel, who invited her under the pretense of meeting with Empire. Demerzel tells her that she will only have her memories of these conversations while having them. On the way to a poisonous apple orchard, Demerzel reveals herself to be a robot and expounds upon the three laws of robotics, as well as the Zeroth Law, to protect humanity above the individual. Demerzel says the robots went to war with each other, and an important man was killed in the name of the Zeroth Law, ending things and leading her to become programmed to serve one person. Demerzel shows the priestess the Prime Radiant from her chest and says she thinks Harry Seldon wanted her to see the end of Empire. She asks the priestess to help her decide what she is if she outlives Empire.
Yes, well, rich with all kinds of metaphors here.
Can I say I'm really glad that we're following up on this when we didn't see anything about the triple blessings last season?
Oh, I'm thrilled that we're back here again. Yes.
Right. And we had this whole bit where Demerzel was going on the journey just as Brother Day was, right?
Yes.
And Brother Day notably did not get a vision. And we never knew if Demerzel did or not, right?
Right. And the fact that massive numbers of people throughout the galaxy practice this religion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering perhaps that it was not all that present on Trantor and in the Empire at its core, because it represented a very large power base.
Right.
That could very well seem to be threatening. And that's why they were so upset when Day said, I'm going to go to the Central Mother Planet. And see what I can do, because there was politicking going on. The whole business of could Empire have a soul because they were clones and not,
right,
quote unquote,
and the answer,
generated.
No.
And I'm trying to remember. I think that Demerzel. No, I guess she didn't actually use the word professor in the whole conversation, but that's exactly the function, I think, that she is asking this priestess to take.
That's true.
Which, again, humanizes this robot so much.
Right.
You know, do robots need advice? Do robots worry about their deeds and their things they do and don't do? And I think it was stated here that for the first time, there will be a Temple of the Luminists established on Trantor.
Yeah.
So I may have gotten that wrong.
I think that's right. At least in this era, right?
Yeah, at least in this era. Yeah. But it was just replete with the mythic and religious symbolism, and particularly the tree. You know, you have this tree with literal golden apples.
That are poisoned.
Formed by the fluids of the executed robots. They are poisonous to humans. I'm reminded of the golden apples of the Hesperus Garden in Greek mythology. Huh. So maybe the dragon is now in the apples.
Can you tell us that myth?
Well, it's more of an image than anything.
Okay.
I think it was the wedding gift of Zeus to Hera, and it's an apple tree. The apples are golden, and it has a dragon wound around the trunk to guard it.
Or is Demerzel the dragon?
Well, you know, she's been the guardian of this Empire thing for a long time, and yet, you know, the golden apples are produced from the dead bodies of her fellow beings.
Right.
So, just layer upon layer upon layer of possible interpretation. And then, of course, we have from the Tanakh, from the Hebrew Testament, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Demerzel is about to offer a large amount of information to the Luminous Priestess of the good and evil done by both humans and robots.
Yeah.
So, you know, trying to eat from this tree wound up not working out too well for Adam and Eve. And, you know, is this going to be a good thing or a bad thing?
I wonder two things. There's a lot of ambiguity there. I wonder two things. I wonder if the priestess, what was her name? Valaris?
I did not catch it.
All right, well, we'll figure this out next time.
I really miss.
Yeah, when we get subtitles, we'll figure this out.
Subtitles.
I wonder if she's going to be chasing the lost time, if she's going to be trying to figure out what memories are deleted when she's not remembering.
Yeah, because we do know that there's at least one planet in the galaxy that has figured out how to do that, and that's the planet to which the day of the dawn of that time and Sarath, the ruler of that planet, escaped to.
And I also wonder is if she figures out that she went to this orchard, and this is not something I've seen, so I'm not like watching ahead and spoiling anything.
No.
But I wonder if she's going to get back to that orchard because she figured out that she was there. Maybe she leaves breadcrumbs or something. And she eats an apple because she can't remember that they're poisonous. Demerzel told her within this conversation that's erased.
Interesting.
I think there's a lot you can do with this.
Absolutely. It's a brilliant, brilliant concept and completely foreign to the books, to the best of my knowledge. I haven't read all the robot series. I've read none of the other one, but it's definitely not in the Foundation series book.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, we're returning to the conflict first raised from season one. Here we have Demerzel, a robot, is a firm follower of the Luminous, and the Luminous themselves view her in that light, even though most would say that she has no soul. Mm. And all, including herself, would say that she's not human. So they're really playing with this borderline thing, which throughout the entire Foundation series, Asimov also does. So do you want to go through the robotic laws just so people know what they are? There might be some listeners who have not encountered those before.
Well, Marilyn, congratulations, you've just invented the positronic brain. What's the first thing that you tell the robot?
A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Rule number two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. Number three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. So it's all, you know, pretty straightforward. Whatever. Right.
It's hierarchical.
Right. Making, you know, either or decisions quite clear. You know, the zeros and the ones. Yeah, I mean, it's binary. And
clear that until Demerzel says it got really complicated.
Because they had the introduction of the zeroth law. The survival of humanity must be prioritized over the survival of any one human. To which the priestess responds, you recognize the greater good.
Can I say something? I thought, I took it as the zeroth law was to combat the complication, was that there were too many complications with figuring out what hurts an individual human, so they added this above it.
That could well be. As I say, I've never read the robot.
Oh, I'm not taking it from that. I'm taking this from the dialogue. I thought that's what Demerzel was saying, but maybe I misread it. I'm misunderstanding what she's trying to say.
I just took it as, you know, after existing for thousands of years with the first three, they finally realized, well, wait a minute. What about this conflict that, you know, oftentimes the survival of the large, it's the classic Spock thing, you know, the needs of the many outweighs the needs of the few or the one.
Right.
At the same time, that phrase, the greater good, has been used in a lot of negative ways. I'm thinking now particularly of the Harry Potter series.
The real world.
Of course, the real world. Yeah, absolutely. So is recognizing the greater good a good thing or a bad thing?
Right.
And I loved how Demerzel complains about how hard her task is. And she says, you humans seem to want extinction.
We are so, pretty good at that.
No, we are. May we be forgiven. She's looking at, you know, eons upon eons upon eons of time with these first three laws and things becoming more and more and more complex, which I guess is sort of a general trend of human development anyway. And then the zeroth law comes along and they hope that it's going to make it better. And they're dealing with ethical questions now. It's not the simple ones and zeros anymore.
Right.
They're asking for judgment, for evaluation. And they're getting kind of close to the squishy edge of humanity's kinds of things.
Right.
So, and the priestess asks her, why did Selden give you an apple you cannot eat? Meaning the prime radiant.
Right.
And Demerzel replies, he wanted me to see the end of Empire. Which is what has projected her own crisis.
Right.
Because she says, I do not know what I am without Empire. And this led me to a speculation. Perhaps Vault Harry wished to introduce uncertainty into Demerzel. Recognizing her as the most difficult opponent in the end because of her fierce desire to maintain Empire. What do you think?
I think that's probably right. This weakens Demerzel because if she gets into a stage of acceptance, she'll fight less.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right with that. I think that's a really great read there. But it's interesting that Vault Harry can't even zero in on that himself. Right? He's not even that quite that sure, it seems like. Or do you think he is sure?
Sure of what?
Why he gave her the Prime Radiant.
No, I'm not. This was the first time I came up with an explanation that seemed even vaguely possible.
I like that explanation a lot. He gave her knowledge as a weapon, but against her.
Which is exactly what the apples of the knowledge of good and evil were all about. So I'm back to all my deep mythic resonances here.
Right.
It's really, really quite extraordinary. Could he... I'm trying to remember how much he actually knew about Demerzel. Or how he eventually heard more about it. We don't know how Vault Harry gets his news, right? So I guess that's kind of...
I think he just knew Demerzel was a robot because he controlled all the molecules within his vault, right? And she was in the vault, so he could sense she was positronic.
Right.
She was not human.
That's right. And that's when he hands it over to her in the first place. So, yeah. But the priestess characterizes it in exactly those terms. He gave you an apple. He gave you a temptation.
Right.
Demerzel is now in the place of Eve.
Hmm.
And she's eaten the apple.
So who's Adam?
Empire?
Or Selden?
I think Empire is the thing that's going to be brought down.
Okay.
By whatever Demerzel
doesn't do. Oh, I just meant the two to populate the Earth. You know, the humans of Selden and the robots of Demerzel.
Well, in a way, the two are definitely invested in the future of humanity. They just have extremely different ideas about how to bring that about.
Right.
But they're both using mathematics. They're both using the binary system. They're both using the zeros and the ones. I mean, it's really, really fascinating to me. So a speculation I had, will Demerzel become susceptible to the mule because she's become so human, quote unquote?
I like that idea a lot. I don't know if it'll work. That was the whole thing last season because we weren't sure if Incarnation Harry, the one with Gail, was a robot or if he was a human. And then the Mentats worked on him, so we assumed human and probably so because he can be in cryosleep. But I don't know. That would be very cool if she could.
And yet, do I remember correctly from the previous season that when they were inside their ship on
Mentats, I said Mentat, it's Mentalic. Sorry.
Thank you.
I'm dooning here.
So.
Go ahead.
You're dooning away, yeah. Harry inside the ship with Gail and Selvor did not register as human.
I don't recall
on the
that.
Screen. Okay, so I guess it was. I know that the mentalists or the person they were looking at initially did not scan correctly
right.
as the person that he was impersonating. Right. Okay, well, we'll leave that for now. And then my other question: will Vault Harry turn Ebling Miss toward the truth about the mule in order to correct the anomaly and help put the plan back online once more?
I don't think Harry knows about the mule. I don't think Vault Harry knows about the mule at all. You know? The mule is an anomaly. And this Selden seems to not have sources out it, right? He didn't know that Empire was holding on. He had to be told that by Ebling Miss. He's the one who's
true.
Secluded.
That's true.
So I think if anything, Ebling Miss goes, hey, this seems bad. What do we do?
Well, that's coming along in the future, I think.
Probably.
So I won't give any more spoilers.
Yep. No book spoilers here. Let's keep it clean, Marilyn.
Well, I always do my best to keep it clean, John. With varying levels of success.
Well, that's the episode. I mean, great first episode, I thought. I'm really excited for the rest of them.
Me too.
We're going to be recording these ahead of time, so you should be getting them the day. I think embargo ends at like 3 a.m. Eastern time on the Fridays after the episode launches. So we'll probably post them at 6 like we usually do on Fridays, you know?
Well, bless you for being awake and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed that early in the morning.
I'm not awake.
You set it all up. You program it.
I tell Patreon to post it at that time.
Gotcha.
I tell Red Circle to post it at that time. Yeah, yeah. Well, please write in to it's not Foundation, sorry, it's empire@thelorehounds.com because we're Empire. We're going to fall at some point.
Oh, please. How sad.
I'm just joking. I don't know. David set up this one, so you'll have to ask him why he made us empire@thelorehounds.com.
Well, maybe to distinguish between the two seasons.
Maybe.
One season was about Foundation, and now this one's about Empire.
Oh, he set this up last season. So it's the same email as last season, empire@thelorehounds.com. Send us emails if you want to get things read on air, and we will read feedback on air once we get a quorum around mid-season.
Yes, it'll be lots of fun. I always love hearing what listeners have to say and think.
Absolutely. And you could also just go onto the Discord and chat with people. Everybody has a good time chatting on the Discord. And we've got episode by episode siloed channels so that you don't have to get spoiled for the next episode if you're not caught up or something like that.
Yes. And now I have to wait 10 more days before there's any possibility of anybody posting on the spoiler thread.
I know.
I can't wait to hear what people think about it.
We're recording this quite early.
Yes, we are. Well, out of necessity.
Right, right.
The blessing and the curse of screeners.
Right. All right. Well, please check out the affiliates. We have Rings and Rituals, as you are aware, Marilyn, because you host it. If you want to listen to Rings of Power content, go over there. Please check out the Radioactive Ramblings podcast. They are doing Fallout lore, and they're doing more Red Rising soon, but don't quote me on that. Go to their feed and you can find out more about what they're doing. But Fallout lore for sure, ahead of season 2 in December. Wool Shift Dust, Alicia just started up her Dune series. It's been coming a long time. She's started it. Go check that out. It's if you like Foundation, you probably like Dune 2. Get into it and have a good time. They're similar worlds-ish.
Yeah.
They're very different stories in similar worlds.
Ish.
Yeah.
But you can definitely see how the one led into the other.
Right. And check out Alicia's Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, too, while you're at it. Properly Howard Movie Review is doing Bacon Wrapped. This is a Kevin Bacon-themed season where they're covering a bunch of movies related to Kevin Bacon, and I still don't fully understand how they did their draft. So go listen to their draft episode if you want to find out how they picked the movies. Really funny stuff over there. So go listen to them.
But what I want to know is, are they going to talk about bacon donuts?
I don't know. You'll have to listen, Marilyn.
Yes,
you know?
That is true.
And never mind the music. Every Tuesday they've got a new episode about psychology and music together. It's a lovely listen. Please go check out Mark and Nicole over there on that feed. And on the Lorehounds feed, we're wrapping up Murderbot. So the Murderbot finale happens at the same time as, or like right before the Foundation premiere. So the same day as the Foundation premiere. We have screeners for that too. So they're both coming out on the same day. So all good.
Yeah.
But so,
except for the Watchers. The Watchers are going to be a little. Well,
Murderbot's a 20-minute episode. So that's, oh, that's much
that's
easier.
That's right. I still haven't managed to get around to that one yet. I do want to, but.
You're going to watch Murderbot?
Well, I thought you said it was.
It gets a little gory sometimes.
Well.
It's funny, though. It's very funny.
We'll see.
It's a comedy, but it's definitely a little gory sometimes. It is called Murderbot, you know?
I mean, I never even had a chance to finish the final season of Doctor Who, so I'm way behind. Am I watching?
You gotta check it out.
I do. I know, and I want to. It's not that I didn't like it or anything. It's just series keep on happening, John. What can you do?
Well, I know David's got Alien Earth coverage coming, but right now you can actually check out some coverage from Alicia on what's the new Marvel show?
Ironheart.
Thank you. My brain's not working tonight. I'm not caught up on Marvel right now. But Ironheart, Alicia's covering that with Jean. So you could check all that out over there. We also
see, that's another series that I want to catch up on.
Well, they did three episodes at a time for that one. Why are they doing that?
God's bless.
All right. Well, we can't stop them. These streamers are just beating us down with all this content.
I'm telling you. Maybe they hope we'll finally stop.
They're trying to kill us with kindness.
We bring good things to them. We bring in listeners, so they should be
supporting us. Oh, the podcast, you're saying. They're trying to get the podcast and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Who knows? Anyway, yeah, and check out the subscriber episodes if you want to get on the Patreon or Supercast. We just did a Wes Anderson film fest with Isle of Dogs and The Royal Tenenbaums. Really fun episode to do with Alicia and David. And we're doing Val Kilmer this month. I think Willow is in the lead right now. If you're a subscriber, make sure you vote on what movie we're covering this month so that you get your say. All right. I'm going to thank everybody now.
Mm-hmm.
Our Discord server boosters, which are, if I can scroll fast enough, Aaron K., Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, Doove 71, Athena A., Tina Lestu, Nancy M., Ghost of Partition, and Radioactive Richard. And our lore masters, Sam Martian, Michael G., Michelle E., Brian P., SC, Peter OH, Adam S., Nancy M., Doof 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Matthew M., Sarah M., Andre B., Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., Dally V., Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W., Lestu, Jeffrey B., Elisa U., Neil F., Ben B., Scott F., Stephen N., Julia F., Kali S., Ilmariel, /Tim, Paul K., Bobby C., and Adrian. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. It's so much fun to hear names that are now recognizable from conversations on the Discord.
I know, right? Everybody's around now. It's great. Yeah. Get on the Discord. It's a fun time. And everybody's welcome, not just the subscribers.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Fun season of Foundation ahead. Marilyn,
oh, yeah.
Thank you for being my co-host. Wait.
Thank you for having me as your co-host, John. And thank you, everyone who's supporting us. And we'll look forward to your emails.
We'll see you next week. The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday.
Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego Chicken Sandwich, Fuego Fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego Chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty Classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego Chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.